From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. As we are increasingly inundated with information from websites like Twitter and Facebook, it's become more difficult to filter out what's important. In his new book, Net Smart, How to Thrive Online, Howard Rheingold guides the way with tips on how to use social networks and crap detection, as he calls it, to figure out what's relevant. We'll talk about filtering the internet for our day-to-day lives, collaborating online, and how virtual communities have changed since Howard Rheingold helped pioneer them. His previous books include The Virtual Community and Smart Mobs, and he joins us for the hour after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of our forum program. And this hour features Howard Rheingold, a Bay Area treasure, as they say, based author, artist, designer, futurist, community builder, who has been writing about digital media for nearly three decades and published such books as Tools for Thought, The Virtual Community, Smart Mobs. He's co-founder of Hotwired and Electric Minds, as well as serving as the former editor of the Whole Earth Review. And he also set up Hotwired, the first online magazine. His most recent book is titled Net Smart, subtitled How to Thrive Online, all about developing a better understanding and deeper use of things like, well, Google, Facebook, Twitter, which Howard Rheingold sees as essential survival skills. And he writes in NetSmart that, and I'm quoting now, quote, the proliferation of media has not stopped. If anything, it has gone into overdrive. If you want to keep up with anything, it's not about keeping up with technologies. It's about keeping up with literacies. Good to have you back on Forum. It's been a long time.
10 years.
I wasn't measuring, but let's not let a decade go by before you come back and grace us with your presence. This is, really all about what you've learned in 30 years, and it has to do with literacies and goes back to your earlier books, which I read with great interest. But a lot of it's really all about how to use the internet intelligently, humanely, good net citizenship.
Yes, and I've done it for two reasons. I think it ought to point in two directions. One is the individual who knows these things is going to do a lot better for themselves than people who don't. But I also see this as really the only way to improve the nature of the commons. You can't do it from the top down. You can only do it by raising the level of cluefulness among the people who use media.
Get back to your TED Talk where you talk about the need for a new narrative about cooperation and distrusting that old hegemonic individualism or something along those lines. I mean, you're trying to shake things up here again. Shame on you. But no, this is all about collective action of literacy, isn't it?
Collective action is why we are not like other primates. We are able to do things together in ways that other creatures can't do. And a lot of our communication and our arts and our civilization comes from the tools that we've built to do things together. And now we've got these fantastic tools that can enable people all over the world, wherever they are, to do things together. And of course, humans do good things and bad things. But I think for the most part, we can see people doing good things for each other in ways that they weren't able to do before.
Yeah, you really come out with a strong kind of sanguine view of humanity here. But you quickly acknowledge that there are those who say, you know, Google's making us stupider. I mean, there's a whole book by that title, that Facebook invades our privacy, that Twitter, well, takes away from our attention.
Chops our attention.
Chops, yeah, that's a good word to describe it. I mean, all of these things you acknowledge are true, but yet they don't necessarily interfere with how we can do things for the collective good or for the commons.
Well, I pay a lot of attention to good technology criticism, and I think we're so immersed in technology, it behooves everyone to pay critical attention to our own media practices. But I have found that criticism, while necessary, isn't sufficient. The book really came out of that need. Knowing that something is broken or that it may have hidden costs does not necessarily tell you what to do about it. And I thought, well, wait a minute. I know something about what to do about it, and I know people who do. So it was not just from my own experience, but I went out to talk to Jimmy Wales about how can you get a bunch of volunteers to build a free encyclopedia for everybody on Earth.
And Wikipedia, yeah.
I talked to Jane McGonigal, who must have been on your show.
She has been, yeah.
How did gamers do good things? You know, I think it was about a month ago, a gaming group using Foldit found a new way to configure the enzyme protease, which is very important in AIDS research. So these are people playing games on the internet, helping AIDS research. There are all kinds of people out there who know something, and I sought them out. I mean, that's part of the fun of writing a book, is going and finding people who know what they're talking about. And I tried to bring their lore to the practical level of, if I had to hand this book to my daughter, who's now past that age, when she was heading for college, what would I tell her about what to do online?
Well, a good example, and you do get personal here, talking about your daughter doing some research on Martin Luther King, comes down to what you call a crap detector. I mean, she came across some information which was misinformation, tracked it down to neo-Nazis, actually, which is kind of a fascinating story in itself, and learned that what we all know, there's all kinds of misinformation on there that can lead us astray and do the farthest thing from enlightening us, just the opposite. So when you talk about a crap detector, you get into a specific way of avoiding it. Triangulation. Check your sources. I mean, just don't go to Snopes, which is what most people do, right?
Oh, we would be better off if most people went to Snopes, you know, but that's one good stop. You know, good journalists try to find three corroborating sources before they're going to pass a report along. And, you know, I remember when Egypt cut down the internet, cut off the internet. I was on Twitter when that happened, and I thought, gee, that would be very interesting if true. But there was nothing on BBC or Al Jazeera, so I sought two other sources before I passed that information along, and I'm glad I did. It's interesting, though, it was 40 minutes before it appeared on BBC, CNN, or Al Jazeera. But there was also, I think, not too long after that, the Haiti earthquake, where there was a rumor on Twitter that if you texted a certain number, you would contribute to medical aid, which turned out to be a cruel hoax. And so I think that it behooves all of us to check the information that we come across before we pass it along. Triangulation. You can teach this to kids. I taught my daughter about looking for an author on a website. That's not that difficult. If everyone was to look up the name of the author who makes a specific claim, I think that we would have less noise and more signal in the system.
Well, you say think like a detective, but think like a journalist as well.
Yes.
And these are good caveats about using the internet wisely. Crap detection, I like. Critical consumption of information and all these things that you invade us to do to bring about more literate skills that you say are survival skills. Why do you call them survival skills?
Well, there are, 2 billion people on the internet and something like 5 billion mobile telephone subscriptions. We've never seen the diffusion of powerful technology happen that rapidly, that far. We are immersed in the system, and I'm all for taking Sabbaths, and I'm all for supporting people who don't want to get connected. But for the most part, educationally, in terms of your career, socially, it really depends on what you know about how to use or not use or not misuse the media around us. I think, you know, kids need to be told before they get online that nowadays everything that you put online is going to be there forever. It's going to be searchable. It can be connected to your name. It can be reproduced. It can be spread around the world. Kids have always done dumb things, and they've always kind of said snarky things about each other, and they've always had their best friends. They've never had them reproduced forever, searchably and reproducibly and able to be broadcast everywhere. You need to know some of these things before you dip your toe in.
Yeah, so if you jump on somebody and cut his hair like Mitt Romney is alleged to have done, it's out there forever and it's somehow never going to go away. We're talking to Howard Rheingold, who is the author of NetSmart, How to Thrive Online, and he's here with us in studio. And, you know, there's also a lot of – I want to talk about the five things that you focus on in this book, but there's a lot of things that go out on the internet that are just staggeringly mundane. You know, people write on Facebook, you know, I swept my walk today. I ate a plum. I mean, you know, things that you just wonder – what are they contributing, if anything? I mean, and I don't know that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, you know,
I think it's a good thing.
Do you? Why?
Okay, two reasons. One is the person who thinks of herself as a contributor to digital culture in however a small way, a participant rather than a passive consumer, is a different kind of citizen. They think of themselves as having more agency in the world. And I think another part of that is we were talking about cooperation and collective action before. The definition of social capital that Robert Putnam has given has to do with networks of trust and norms of reciprocity. So when you meet a stranger, you talk about the weather, you talk about sports, you kind of take the temperature of that person. And I think sharing what you have for lunch every day is kind of boring.
And maybe narcissistic, too.
And maybe narcissistic, but saying, I'm sitting under my plum tree, I'm very happy to be able to do so, gives people a sense of you as a human being. Maybe they will trust you enough to give you a little bit of their time and information. And what I've found is that people ask me to not just broadcast information. I'm a writer. That's what I do. They want to know a little bit about what I'm seeing of the world, what I'm like as a human being. And when I do that, when I put a request out there, it comes back to me 100-fold. People see you as a human. They are more likely to want to cooperate with you, to communicate with you. So small talk lubricates trust. Certainly, it's trivia, and it's not going to do you much good to spend all day with trivia. But I think throwing in a little bit of the human element is not a bad idea.
Well, let's talk another element of that. You go all the way back to the well, and I remember having a conversation with Stuart Brand about, who also goes all the way back to the well, about why people flame. Use the internet really to flame. I mean, maybe it has to do with the isolation, the fact that they're alone. But things that people would never say face-to-face, they do say on the internet. And a lot of it's toxic.
You know, they can't punch you in the nose. I think that's the biggest part of it is this the sense of safety that nobody's looking at you, nobody can punch you in the nose. There's also the lowering of inhibitions that comes when you can't hear somebody, you can't see somebody. We transmit a lot of our humanity and our tone of voice and our body posture, our facial expressions. When all of those are removed, people are a little less human. And I think that's one of the reasons for trying to understand some of these things. There are limits to the media. And if you don't see what those limits are, you can do egregious harm to yourself and to others.
And I'm struck by your use of the words less human, because I remember our conversation from even 10 years ago when you talk about virtual reality as opposed to the real deal, as opposed to what we think of as our human connectedness. This is connectedness, but it's connectedness often of a different kind. It lets it releases and deletes, if you will, those things that you were just mentioning, the human connection, eye contact, and facial expressions, and countenance, and so forth.
Well, of course, we're gaining some of that in the medium, in the sense that that's kind of a technological issue. Now that I can bring my students into a space where we can see each other via video and listen to each other, people from all around the world, we all agree that it's a very different experience from the ones that we've done for years online, where we have exchanged words and maybe we have posted pictures and links. There's something that face-to-face can't be duplicated online, but a great deal of that signaling can be duplicated with audio and video. So I think we're getting a richer form of communication than we used to have. Are people going to – here's a research question for some sociologists. Are people going to flame each other when we have universal audio and video, or is that an artifact of the text-only world?
I think it's a good question. We'll have to probably wait on that a little bit till the technology amps up a bit. But when you were talking about students, your students, and I know you've been teaching at Stanford, in the book you write about, you know, a student essentially surfing the net while you're teaching. I've had this experience too. I think, you know, it's rude and it can be disconcerting and all that, but you talk about the student as kind of an outlier. You know, it could multitask, do the net surfing and also absorb what you're saying. And then you go on also to talk about how 1 in 6, I don't know how we come to this figure, but 1 in 6 people will essentially have their consciousness or their attention go astray. The woman who is texting and walks into a—
Right. That was Pew Internet in American Life. It's amazing. 1 in 6 Americans admitted to bumping into something while texting. And who has not had the horrifying experience practically on a daily basis of noticing that someone who is driving on the same road as you is texting? So clearly these screens are attention magnets, and they challenge us in ways that are maybe physically fatal some ways. Attention is so important.
That's one of your five pillars.
Attention is the fundamental literacy, I believe, because how are you going to do crap detection, critical consumption of information, if you don't pay attention? And how are you going to be a good participant, or how are you going to collaborate if you haven't, at least to some degree, mastered your attention? So when I walked into the classroom and saw the students not looking at me but looking at their laptops, well, first of all, I teach a course on social media, so I can't do what many professors do, and it's quite okay for them to do it. Just tell them to shut their laptops and pay attention. I want them to pay attention to how they are paying attention to their media. So the first thing I did was I asked their permission. I took out a little camera, and I took a picture of what they looked like from where I stood. And then I projected it the next week on the screen, put it online as well. And I put a camera at the back of the classroom when I projected it. And I caught one student who was, for some reason, while I was projecting that video of the class, he was watching it on his laptop. And then he decided to look at my website. And then he decided to do his email. What really started me to thinking was that this student was a rare A-plus student. If I had stopped him and asked him what I was talking about, I bet you he would have been able to tell me. So we don't really know. But Cliff Nass, the Stanford professor whose work has been replicated, has pretty much demonstrated that 95% of people who think they are multitasking to be more efficient are actually degrading their performance by multitasking. Multitasking is not more efficient in most instances. But what about that other 5%? Was that kid, was he born that way? Some people can run faster, or did he learn something? And so I'm interested in what might he have learned? Can we learn to train our attention so that we know when to multitask and when not to multitask? It's called metacognition, and Wikipedia has a great page about it. Just knowing that you're paying attention is extremely important. It's the basis of all meditation.
Yeah, you've got all kinds of new lexical things here. I wasn't familiar with metacognition or micro decisions or playbore. What is playbore exactly?
So when you tag a photograph on Flickr, or you offer a comment to a YouTube video, you're actually contributing to the market value of Yahoo and Google when you do that. Now, I think it's a great trade-off. The cost of me putting my own videos up on my own server, the technicalities, I'd rather not do it. I'd rather contribute my free material to Google and Yahoo making money on it. But they are benefiting from my labor. We're seeing more subtle forms of that. There's a game that Google put out where random people in the world who want to play this game can match up with a player somewhere, and you both see an image and you both try to guess what the image is. And until you both agree on it, the game isn't, that round isn't over. That's actually a way of training Google's vision recognition. So they are harnessing the labor of the game players. And there are people who think that this is just the beginning and we are a massive exploited population. Maybe think of us as a higher level of the Foxconn workers, except we're doing it with our minds. I happen to think that the key difference between being exploited and a fair trade-off is informed consent. Do you know that people are using your decisions and your material to make money?
We're talking with Howard Rheingold. His new book is Net Smart: How to Thrive Online. And let me give you an opportunity to join this conversation. Some thoughts of yours are welcome. Any questions or comments, you can join us by calling our toll-free number, which is 866-733-6786. Again, feel free to call us now and join us in this discussion at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have right on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or go to our Facebook page. Lots of ways to intelligently use the media and what's available to you to join us. And let's talk about these five pillars just to get them out there. Crap detection we've talked about, which is really critical consumption of information. Attention, participation, collaboration, all of which kind of really tie in together and make perfect sense. Network smarts.
Well, so that one, I think, is a little bit more esoteric because I think people know about smart mobs and virtual communities and collective intelligence and all of the other ways that people can collaborate online. They know a lot about the way people participate with blogs and wikis and Twitter, but there are pieces of knowledge that are not that complex, but they're sequestered in different disciplines. So we're now seeing the emergence of network science. Most people have heard about the small world effect, the idea that the shapes of networks, the form of network can influence what people in those networks can do, that the power law and the long tail, those are terms that people may be slightly familiar with, may not completely understand. If you know more about how small world networks come about, how the power law works for attention, how the long tail works for commerce, you are going to do better online. We also have sociologists. I teach Irving Goffman's work because he wrote about the way we present ourselves to others and the way others perceive us decades before the internet, but it's perfectly applicable to the internet. Most students, if they're not sociology students, have never heard of Irving Goffman, but by golly, on their Facebook profiles, they are engaged in presentation of self every day. You know, at the macro level, we've got Manuel Castells, who's saying it's really a misnomer to say that we're in an information society. We've been in an information society since Gutenberg. We are in a network society, and human social networks go back to the birth of humanity. We are human because we socialize in certain ways.
So that's why networks matter. That's why you say network and network building is really a central part of this literacy.
Oh, absolutely. And knowing how they work. Social capital is a term that people use a lot. And social capital has everything to do with trust in networks.
And again, you mentioned Robert Putnam, Bowling Alone, where we've come to use that term, or from whom we've really borrowed that term in terms of its many meanings. We're coming up on a break, and I want to, again, invite you to join the conversation. We're talking with really one of the pioneer theorists and visionaries of the internet, Howard Rheingold, whose previous books include The Virtual Community and Smart Mobs, and his new book out is NetSmart, How to Thrive Online. Some of you might talk about ways that you find thriving online or enhancing the use of literacy in terms of, well, online skills and the world of the internet. These are important questions, and they're important questions because they concern and are applicable to so many people. Feel free to join us. You can do that by phone again at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or go to our Facebook page. And we'll continue with Howard Rheingold. We'll also hear from you when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Howard Rheingold. His new book is called NetSmart, How to Thrive Online. And it's really all about the digital world and how much information is too much and, how to figure out ways of using it in smarter ways, using networks in smarter ways and crap detector, as he calls it, borrowing a bit from Hemingway and cleaning him up in a way. We got to figure out when we use the internet what's relevant, how much information we need and how to use that information to get more light and knowledge. And we're talking about just really the filtering of the net for our day-to-day lives, collaborating online, how virtual communities have changed since Howard Rheingold helped to pioneer them. In fact, here's Kate who sends in an email that says, Howard Rheingold has revolutionized the experience of online community. It is an honor to know him and an education to hear him. Howard, live forever. We did a program, by the way, David Ewing Duncan, about longevity. Maybe on the cusp of pushing that many, many years more than we thought. Tim says, you've been an observer, writer, and user of online services since the earliest days of the well. What has taken you most by surprise with the widespread adoption of the World Wide Net?
We knew back then that a lot of people would be doing this because it's important to be able to connect with people who you may not have known but with whom you share an interest. And that's, I think, the secret sauce of the virtual community business. You could not have really envisioned YouTube or Google Hangouts, people doing video to each other 10 at a time back when we were looking at words on a screen crawling by at 1200 bits per second. So it was and the fact that we would walk around with these phones in our pockets, that even 10 years ago when I was writing about that, the idea that you would stream video from a news event from your telephone and that most people in the world would have one of these, that was hard to imagine.
There's a listener who comments online. He says, it seems Howard Rheingold has been wrong about everything he wrote concerning the power of online communities. The Well community, for example, was unable to see the forest for the trees with the rise of the web when Bruce Katz attempted to create a web interface for the service, and now the Well is a has-been service only kept alive through the benevolence of Salon's owner.
Steve Case friended me on Facebook, and I emailed him and I said, I know who you are. Why do you know who I am? And he said, I lurked on the Well for a long time before I started AOL. If you ask Craig Newmark what the secret to Craigslist is, he said, I learned about community on the Well. So, I think Friendster failed, but without Friendster, would we have Facebook?
No, I don't think we would.
it's evolutionary, and there are good reasons why the Well has not grown, but as a place that has seeded many, many, many other enterprises, it was enormously successful.
I'm going to go to calls in just a moment, but I want to read a few more emails. This is from Owen up in Sonoma, who says, some years ago, I interviewed Stuart Brand for Forbes, and he told me that he considered email the most intimate form of communication yet. I doubted that at the time, not yet being an email user, but now I see how prescient he was. Email lets us all be Voltaire, but without the quill pens and ink blots. On the other hand, email has come close to killing the phone conversation, a form I was quite good at. I do miss those auditory oral pleasures.
To each its own. I am an avoider of voicemail. I guess I ought to get one of those services that turns my voicemail into email so that I can scan them. But my hearing is a little bit impaired. And when your hearing is a little bit impaired, you notice that people mumble on their voicemail. Please call me at Furtfriedhof. And it's infuriating. So I would rather have people send me an email and tell me to call them back.
That sounds like a number of voicemails I've had. Very well done. Christine says, instructions for living a life, pay attention, be astonished, tell about it. Nicely put. And a listener comments online, the internet connects people in a positive way in that whereas in person a slick talker or manipulative person can pull one over on you, online their interpersonal power is gone. If they push your nonsense claims or bogus logic like what you see in religion, politics, and current events, we the people can call them on their stuff and defeat them based on logic and rationality. Let's go to you, our callers, and we begin with Audrey. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
So I work at a very large tech company in the Bay Area in San Jose that specializes in networking equipment and solutions, and a lot of those are based on collaboration and video and video conferencing and teaching environments. So my question was on social media, and up until now it's been used mostly for personal use, for social use. How do you see that being used in the workplace to make workers more productive, and then how do you see it also being an issue around generational diversity in the workplace and understanding how to use that and interpreting it as being productive as opposed to just a waste of time?
I think the first thing to understand is that social media historically have not come into workplaces through any kind of deliberate process or any kind of decision by management. the PC came into the workplace because young people were using spreadsheets. And I remember talking to many executives who said keyboards are for secretaries. They used to be called secretaries. And I think the internet, clearly, we would not have the tech world we have today if engineers were not communicating with engineers through Usenet for competing companies. And if their bosses knew what they had been doing, they would have shut it down. But that's really how Silicon Valley grew. I think a negative instance is instant messaging. Who would have known that people would have brought their friend lists into the office, making themselves interruptible to everybody in the world that they knew during their workday? And now, of course, email has become overwhelming. You know, there are policies that people need to learn when they join a company. They need to learn about the sexual harassment policies. How often when people join companies are they told, please don't BCC 13,000 people. Please put a subject line on your email. So I think that we've seen social media entering the workplace accidentally. And now it's time for people to think about the way this does or does not fit into what our goals are. And in terms of the generations, I think there's a tremendous opportunity there because in the past, the role of human resources is to teach the young people the way the old people did things. And nowadays, if you listen to those young people as they join you, you may learn something about a future medium that you could use in your company. I'm not saying that they're going to be all wise, but they're certainly going to be tuned into things that some of the older folks may not have known.
And let me thank Audrey for her call. Go to more calls in just a moment. You do concede in your book, though, that social media isolates, and you agree with the charge that it may indeed make us more shallow.
Well, I would be careful about the generalization there. Barry Wellman is a sociologist at the University of Toronto who's done a lot of empirical studies that reveal that the use of social media is not a cause of social isolation. We are seeing social isolation, and I think that there's a bigger question about the technological society that we live in. I mean, certainly all around the world this morning, hundreds of millions of people got in their single-passenger automobiles and drove to cities of inhuman scale where they got into buildings with thousands of people and then sat in cubicles looking at screens. Certainly there's something alienating going on there, and the looking at screens is part of it, but it's not the only part of it. It's a trade-off. I think it is an affordance for people who want to avoid face-to-face reality.
It's also shifting our attention span, isn't it?
It is shifting our attention, and I'm not so sure that that's a bad thing. Do we want to continue with the kind of attentional training that was involved in turning farm boys into assembly line factory workers? You know, when my daughter started school, I was appalled. I remembered for the first time, oh, you sit there, and then they ring a very loud bell at you, and then you move. And then you go to another room where you sit in a row. I think, you know, Kathy Davidson wrote a book called Now You See It recently about the way our attention is changing. And I think we need to take control of that. The downside of that is you see the people bumping into each other while they're texting, see the people texting while they're driving. You see, we wouldn't have popular cute cat videos if people didn't on impulse click on links that were sent to them. I think the real danger is untrained attention, unthinking attraction. You know, just as a real danger with television was you just got sucked into it and then your life went by and you were sitting in a dark room. I think that human agency is important and that we have choices. And I think that alienation is a danger and paying attention in the wrong way is a danger. And we need to take care of that danger by learning how to do it more effectively and more humanely.
Also has to do with overload, doesn't it? I mean, when you think about all the emails that come in one day, I'm not even talking about spam. You know?
Yes. The problem with email is the miracle of email. You can email anybody in the world, but you don't want everybody in the world to email you. That's sort of a tragedy of the commons there. And I think there's way too much email, and I think that we're way too addicted to it, myself included. And there's the fear of going away for a week and getting off grid and coming back.
We need 12-step programs, you think? Something like that. No, I mean, it can be really an addiction. I mean, it's for many people. In fact, all of the things we're talking about in the social media, have to go to my Twitter. I have to, you know, I mean, it's something that, in fact, you know about this, the neuroscience of this, that you get kind of a high and then it goes and recycles itself over and over again.
Well, we're rewarded for connecting with other humans. And we're rewarded for hunting and gathering. And both of those things are alive online.
We'll get more of our callers online. Timothy, join us.
Hello, Michael.
Yes, sir.
Hello, Michael and Howard. Regarding thriving online and presidential campaigning, regarding the Clinton-Gore presidential campaign, Al Gore said that Tabitha Thorne and her interviews were instrumental in success on MTV and their political success. And then Obama, regarding his political campaign, it was indicated that the Black Planet website was instrumental in their success. What is it now in the power of the online communities? Who is going to be instrumental in success for these political candidates?
Well, for coming up to an election, the political parties need to capture the attention of the people who might vote for them, and then they need to make sure that those people get out and actually vote. So social media are a great way of capturing that attention. Maybe people who
certainly helped Obama enormously in the last election, enormously.
Yes, and you know, my students were involved in that. I had one student mashed up together something he called Ubama, in which he asked students to make 30-second videos about why they were voting for Obama, and then voted those up so that the most popular ones were available. Tremendous amount of student enthusiasm that was, I think, spread very widely through social media. I think that no single party has a monopoly now on knowledge about it. I do think you need to credit the Howard Dean campaign for really breaking ground there. Never before was there a candidate that was not selected by the party bosses, but was selected essentially by bloggers and fundraising. Before
if he only wouldn't have shouted. You know,
yes,
might have made it across the finish line. Let me thank the caller. Talk if you would. And Howard Rangel is here with us in studio this hour. His new book is called NetSmart and How to Thrive Online, about just ways that people can specifically cut down on what I would call the social media noise. A lot of it out there. I mean, how do you diminish it? How do you essentially cut through?
Well, I work with my students to try to develop habits. First of all, I think this matter of metacognition, of knowing where you're putting your attention. You need to make decisions. Am I going to click on that link? Am I going to maybe open a tab for it on my browser and look at it later? Am I going to bookmark it to look at it much later? Or am I going to ignore it? You need to make those decisions consciously, and I think most of us make them unconsciously. As I said, we wouldn't have so many cute cat videos if people didn't click on impulse. Now, you need to do
that.
Are
you a cat lover?
Pardon?
You a cat lover, cat owner?
No, I'm not.
Oh,
I'm
thought not. Maybe you get more of those than I do. They come rarely to me, but
But they're extreme.
But again, it goes into what you describe as virtual communities. A lot of people who get a lot of those are really cat lovers or know when to have cats, yeah?
Absolutely. You know what? One of the fascinating things I learned from Clay Shirky was he noted that Flickr made it possible for communities to form around people who take pictures of cats in bathtubs. Apparently, there's a whole world of people who take pictures of cats in bathtubs.
There is a whole online thing with cats dressed up to look like Hitler.
Yes.
I don't know if you've seen that. I mean, there's some crazy stuff out there. I happen to be a dog lover, so I get a lot of stuff about dogs, but not so much about cats.
But to get back to making decisions about attention, you have to make them in the context of what you intend to get done for the day. So I myself and advise my students and taught my daughter, write down, good old right brain, pencil and paper, three things you want to get done today, and just two or three words each, and put that in the periphery of your vision, what you want to get done online, and put it near your screen. And when your gaze falls upon it, simply ask yourself, is what I'm doing now going to get me to where I need to get by the end of the day? I'm not asking you to admonish yourself or to make any changes in your routine. I'm only asking you to add a little layer of awareness.
Well, there's a new study, I believe, that shows demonstrably that if you don't, I mean, personally get up in the morning, start work, and go to personal email before anything else. If you don't do that, you're more productive. I mean, it just makes sense when you think about it. I'll get another caller on. Michelle, join us. Hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for picking my call.
Sure. Welcome.
I think I'm a new mom of a seven-month-old, and I've benefited tremendously from turning to the networked social web for pregnancy advice, parenting advice, and especially breastfeeding. I don't know that I could have been successful in breastfeeding if I just relied on friends, family members, even my doctors. When you turn online, there's a lot of poor advice out there, but there's also a lot of evidence-based information that can be really helpful. And when I think back to what's helped me be a good mom so far, the web has really helped.
Well, thank you.
By connecting me to information that I wouldn't have gotten otherwise.
There's your virtual community again that Howard Reingold made us aware of low those many years ago. And Michelle, I appreciate hearing from you. Thank you. Here's Marilee, who says, my daughter used Instagram frequently. Her husband was shocked when a colleague showed him that Instagram was using their 3.5-year-old daughter's picture on their homepage. Intellectually, we all know that the I have read this agreement is usually a lie because no one has the time nor the inclination to read every contract out there. Ironically, my daughter and son-in-law have both been in the IT world. Son-in-law still is, but they were both really chagrined at the use of their very young daughter's picture without permission. How do you feel about this?
So there's your example of Playboy, isn't it? That when you sign up for Instagram, it's a wonderful service, and I use it, and I love it. And I didn't read my – who reads the terms and conditions thoroughly? If I had a 3-year-old daughter and found that her picture was being used to advertise Instagram, then I would think twice about what I had done. I would also think twice about putting too many photos of my children online or putting them on Facebook. You know, I said much earlier in the hour that what you put online is going to stay there forever. And is your child, do they have informed consent when you put their picture up? I mean, I don't know the answer to that question, but a lot of people create websites for their children before they're born. They're creating a digital identity without really the consent of the child. So I think that Playboy issue depends on if enough people say to Instagram, this is really irritating to me and I'm going to quit Instagram, then they may respond to that. If nobody cares, well, that's where Facebook came from.
Here's Michael from Mill Valley who writes, I recently read that Facebook tweaked their algorithm in such a way that a user is most likely to see newsfeed items from friends who share that user's political and social views. Likewise, I also hear that Google's search algorithm also favors results that mirror the user's individual preferences. Seems to me this creates a feedback loop that could negatively impact our already very fractured political and social landscape. Can we afford to have less understanding and knowledge about opposing viewpoints? This is troubling to me. I'd love for your guests to comment.
Such an important question. So I have my students read Cass Sunstein's article that he wrote a number of years ago.
Aside from Van Jones, the favorite bête noire of Glenn Beck.
Oh, yes. The daily, he called it The Daily We. And he was riffing on Nicholas Negroponte, who in the olden days said, someday we will be able to put all of our news sources together and make our own customized daily newspaper, The Daily Me. And in fact, of course, we can do that. And the fear is that people are going to pay more and more attention to sources that they agree with. And then the notion of the filter bubble about the search engines showing us things that are more like what we're looking for. In my book, I give the advice that you need to find people that you follow. I talk about what I call personal learning networks. You need to find people whose intelligence and knowledge and honesty you respect, but with whom you disagree. If you don't have several people in your network who annoy you on a regular basis, then you're probably in an echo chamber. And you know, I fear that there's no way to do this except educate people to pay attention to things that irritate them, and that's hard to do. So I don't see that there's any top-down way of mandating this, but I do see this as a real danger of the marvelous access to information that we have. I wonder whether things are any different today than they used to be, whether people used to listen to the opposition more than they do now. But I know that back in the heyday of newspapers, newspaper editors tried to bring in a variety of viewpoints that you may not see if you're only rolling your own news feed.
Well, we do that. I mean, you know, we get accused of being too liberal and progressive. We also get accused of being too conservative. But, you know, that's the point, that we have a lot of different viewpoints here. And we have a lot of callers, so let's get some of you on here. Jose from Corte Madera, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. My question is, because I've been raised by a father who was a pro in etiquette. He was a diplomat, and his specialty was etiquette. And he always said to me, he taught me that civility, etiquette, is a pulse of a civility of a society. My question to your guest is, as I see the society in technology advancing, which is great, but our etiquette to catching up to that technology is becoming wider, wider, and it takes longer to make these two fields compatible. My question is there going to be a science or a book written about how to become more etiquette in a society in regard to the technology that is going to be invented? And then my second comment is there any difference between intelligence and wisdom? Because what I am seeing, and that's a comment, is that we're becoming more intelligent and smart in doing multitask, but I see very little wisdom or wise people evolving out of this technology. Thank you.
Okay, Jose, thank you. Howard Rangel.
Well, that was the main reason I wrote the book, was that I don't see education institutions changing quickly enough to meet the challenges that are posed by technologies. And I wrote this not just to educate people, but to educate parents, because I think the facts of life now include not just sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but technology. And parents are a little afraid that their kids know more than they do. And that's why I wrote the book. It's why I started teaching 8 years ago. I didn't feel that students were being confronted with the issues that the media they use raise, issues that such as the ones you've mentioned, issues of identity and community and collective action. So I think that's a real problem. That also, I think there's a larger problem that our education system, as many critics have noted, is largely about teaching obedience. And the kind of world I'm talking about is one in which you need to think critically about information. You can't trust the authority of the text. You have to be a critical thinker. And as a parent and as a teacher, it's a pain to raise a child or encourage students to question you. So questioning authority is something that our school system is really not built to do.
Remember those bumper stickers, question authority? But I'm also reminded of a book, perhaps I'm pretty sure you knew, Neil Postman and Charles Weingarten's book, Teaching as a Subversive Activity.
That was the book that I turned to.
That was the Bible at one point for many of us who were early would-be teachers of, say that particular persuasion. I've got a couple of emails here I want to read because one is online and one is an email, but they sort of go to distinct differences that I'm sure reflect a lot on your thinking. This is what we talked about, human and not human, or less than human, virtual versus human. And this is a listener, Brian, who writes, "A digital realm like driving isolates us from our fellow humans. Flaming on the internet is analogous to road rage while driving. This isolation causes a lowering of inhibitions, which perhaps provides a window into who we are as humans. After all, our predisposition for greed, dominance, and obsession are rooted in the instincts for survival that aided the evolution of the human species and today remains as part of our lizard brain. So I posit, doesn't this show more of what it means to be human, not less?" Keep that in mind for a moment. Here's Tim, who writes online, "Staring at your own private screen is fundamentally disengaging and destructive to true community. Real community has been sacrificed to virtual community. This becomes increasingly obvious every day. We need to evolve to limit our screen time."
If you want to find out something that's not just armchair philosophy and is based on some empirical evidence, then I would Google The Community Question by Barry Wellman, who's, as I mentioned, a sociologist who has really studied the issue. Community is a word that's kind of a projective test. A sociologist by the name of George Hillier found 95 different definitions in the literature.
I still think one of the best books is, who's that Israeli guy from Georgetown?
Etzioni.
Etzioni, excuse me, yeah.
So there's a tendency to think that true community is something that used to happen before the internet, before the automobile, before the railroad, before we moved out of the farms, that there was these nice little villages where everybody knew each other. You know, a nice little village where everybody knows each other is a nice place, unless you're a little different, in which case you flock to cities. That's where the cities came from. So, you know, I don't object to the – absolutely agree with the idea that staring at a screen affords alienation. I've looked into this quite a bit, and I think you need to be careful about generalizing that it causes alienation. There was a previous a caller asked about wisdom. I guarantee you, if you are stricken by cancer, you are going to not be able to move from your house a lot. And if you are online, you are going to find wise, kind, compassionate, helpful people who are going to help you get through that. There are people listening to me who know what I'm talking about.
Howard, good to see you again. Thank you. We have to have more conversations. Howard Rangel's new book is Net Smart, and Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Amanda Stupai, Tina Larberg, and Irene Noguchi. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. And our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, thank you for listening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.